Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
I arrived by bus shortly after daybreak, my first time in Sarajevo. The four-year siege had ended 15 months earlier, and in the morning half-light the sheer scale of destruction was something to behold, a city pulverised by history. I passed the train station, long since bombed out of service. Two charred skyscrapers loomed in their own shadows. Countless shops and houses burnt out, any structure still standing, pockmarked by bullet holes. The famed Holiday Inn, located in the crosshairs of Sniper's Alley, had taken numerous hits but contrived, somehow, to stay open for business. There was only a trickle of visitors to this once thriving city. With so few hotels operating, local people took in visitors for 20 Deutschmarks a night. I got an address in the old town, an apartment off Ferhadia Street, a beautiful Austro-Hungarian-style building that had taken its share of punishment from snipers in the surrounding hills. I was met by a middle-aged man in a wheelchair, Dusan Filipan. I took his spinal injury to be war-related. In fact, it was due to a car accident in France many years earlier. Hearing I wanted a room for a few nights, he led me through the kitchen to a cluttered back bedroom. I was distracted by sudden movement, a head of curls surfacing from under the covers, a girl in her early 20s, sleepy dark brown eyes. She looked directly at me and yawned. "Mirna," said Dusan, introducing his daughter. "Un café?" Bothered by the notion that I was turfing his daughter out of her room, I told Dusan I could find somewhere else. "No, no," he replied in French, lighting up the first of many cigarettes. "She just stayed over," he explained. "Mirna has a place of her own, the other side of town." And so I stayed with the Filipan family for the next 5 days. Mirna, it turned out, was in drama school and took to experimental theatre. She had a vivid intensity and, like so many in the Balkans, smoked incessantly. Nervous energy betrayed by a constantly tapping foot. The Filipan family and I were to become good friends. Dusan's soft-spoken wife, Melika, was a physics professor at university. She too spoke French better than English. Melika was Muslim. Dusan was Serb. They paid no heed to religious or ethnic distinctions and regarded themselves as Sarajevan. War upended their lives. Their eldest daughter, Mirella, had escaped to Canada with her husband and their two children, and during the siege, Mirna was dispatched to safety in Brussels. Ceasefire in Sarajevo gave the young actress a chance to visit home, only for the fighting to start again, trapping her, like tens of thousands of others, in a nightmare that made an audience of the outside world. From there on, each time I visited the city, I would stay with the Filipans. Over long nights of coffee, rakia and cigarettes, Dusan told me how his neighbours would race downstairs to the basement when the daily bombardment would begin. Paraplegic Dusan was left stranded in their first floor apartment, shielded by a wardrobe blocking the window. One day, unhinged by sniper fire, he finally cracked. He dragged the wardrobe away from the window and sat in full view of snipers, holding aloft a placard, begging them to shoot him. Conversations of the night I will never forget. Back in Sarajevo several years later, I wanted to visit the Filipans, not as a lodger, but as a friend. And so I found somewhere else to stay and made for Ferhadia Street, armed with wine and rakia. Dusan and I could sit at the kitchen table as before, pick up where we'd left off. I rang the bell. Melika opened the door in a blue and white shop coat she used to wear at home. Dusan was in a hospital for stomach surgery, she said, inviting me in for coffee. I asked her about Mirna, wondering if she might be performing in town.
"You do not know?" faltered Melika.
"Mirna," she said, "is not living." I presumed her words to be lost in translation. I told her in French,
I did not understand. The next moments filled with a very loud silence before she explained how her treasured daughter, the spark and soul of the Philippon family, a girl with dreams of stardust, had died from carbon monoxide poisoning. The culprit? A defective gas boiler in the apartment shower. Comme ça, shrugged Melika, motionless in her shop coat, a silhouette against evening sunshine. Like that, indeed. A 26-year-old girl sent abroad for safety, who survived bullets and bombs in wartime Sarajevo, only for jerry-built piping in the city gas supply to kill her in peacetime while she washed herself. Comme ça. Melika said she was visiting Dušan in hospital and asked, would I come with her? We made our way across the city, stepping through blobs of bright red paint splashed on pavements to signify where lives had been lost. At the hospital, Melika asked me not to say anything about Mirna's death. Dušan had seen the story in a newspaper, but had chosen not to believe it. It was more than he could bear. In striped pyjamas, he lay on the bed, smoking a cigarette. Ah, Frankie, he smiled, sitting up. Words seemed superfluous. We looked at each other and, as though connected by the same impulse, collected at Dušan's bed, leaning into a three-way embrace, tears flowing silently for a sadness we could not articulate. I never saw Dušan again. He died within a year. Melika moved out of Feridea Street, the onset of Alzheimer's providing her with a confused reprieve from living pain. On my last visit, I knew it was only a matter of time. Earlier this year, her daughter contacted me from Canada to say that Melika had finally succumbed, releasing her from a world that made no sense. And so my next visit to Sarajevo will be very different. From the bus station, I will walk towards Feridea Street, thinking of three special people who, 22 years ago, entered my life, welcomed me to their city by opening up their family home. Friends then, friends now. Comme ça.
For 2 days, the sea hung grey with rain under a sky so low that the mast of my boat perforated the soft clouds, recalling the bumper cars of my Crosshaven holidays. The water is glassy and slothful, and although the sails hang like loose flannel trousers, I am still making enough way not to have to turn on my engine. Nothing really dries on a wooden boat. Clothes are a salty damp, sleeping bags are slightly better, and matches always hard to light. My chart, although still functioning perfectly, probably hasn't been fully dry for years. A big chart, covering Kenmare River to Cork Harbour, with old trips marked in soft pencil and permanent corrections in violet ink. There are details priceless to the mariner. Tides, currents, depths, anchorages, light patterns, wrecks and contours, all designed to make passages safer. I had scribbled a reminder in pencil on the back. It's important to know where the rocks are, but it is more important to know where they are not. My compass points due north and has been like that all morning since I got my bearing from the light on the old head. Every lighthouse has a unique pattern and the old head flashes twice every 10 seconds. If you find a second light, you can calculate where you are. I need to head dead north now, a bearing of 0 degrees, going nowhere, going home. They say that when sailors are on land, all they want is to be at sea, and when they are at sea, all they want is to get the boat safely home. But today, it is the close of a long journey, and I feel like a schoolboy at the end of August. More than once, I questioned what I was doing. More than once, I thought of pulling the tiller toward me until my compass pointed one more time to the heat of Bilbao, the reciprocal course of 0 degrees, the polar opposite of going home. I am sailing in the cold 50s of latitude, as far from the warm equator as Alaska to the west and Holland to the east. The light is scant, watery, and it always falls obliquely, even at the height of summer. My GPS cheerfully shows bars and restaurants and even a pizza truck waiting ashore. My chart, however, shows Ballymakeen, Killowney, Courtabartine, right across to Prahan. My awkward, huge, pencil-marked chart that I can still pore over for hours. All the pilot books warn you of the dangers of a West Cork landfall. The Admiralty pilot warns those who sail up from the south. Fogs, bad weather, and the long nights of winter frequently render it impossible to obtain a position. Under such circumstances, the course steered, the log, the lead, and nature of the bottom are the seaman's only guides. The floor rolls a little in the swell and the land sinks under the sea again. When it reappears, it rises from the water changed. There is some light in the western sky and the slate grey that surrounded me is lightening and warming. There is a distant smell of garlic coming from the land. The first time I smelled this, I was impressed with the vast amounts of garlic Kinsale restaurants used, but found out later that it is the smell of wild garlic that grows profusely along the coast. I start to imagine I can hear the sounds of Kinsale public houses, a clatter of glasses, a call for beer along the bar. But it is the halyards on my mast and seagulls squawking overhead. The radio crackles me out of my reverie. This is Cork Coast Guard Radio with a sea area forecast. A frontal depression lies over Ireland. A freshening southeasterly airflow will develop during the afternoon and evening as a ridge of high pressure approaches from Bilbao. The low centre will track along the south coast tomorrow and then fade like a distant memory. The forecast and my dreams mixing up one more time. Out of habit, I record it in the log and write in the pressure, the course steered, or speed, and finally, I put an X on the chart marking my position. I am proud of the straight line of X's all the way from Bilbao north. Tonight, there will be a hot shower, clean clothes and sheets. There will be food cooked by somebody else and beer from a tap. There will be family to love and friends to make me laugh. There may even be singing. There will definitely be singing. I am home now, but here are still patterns that tell us all where we are. Not from a lighthouse, but from the tone of voice, the raising of an eyebrow. There are cardinal marks to let us know how far we have come. There are obstacles and shallows and low tides to be navigated. There are storms to be weathered and doldrums to be sat out, and all to be done without a damp, pencil-marked chart. There is, however, a strange comfort in going to sleep with the certain knowledge that your bed will not be in collision with an oil tanker. A comfort in not getting up on the hour to look at the horizon. A comfort in being home.
It's the 40th anniversary of my alma mater, Dublin City University, or NIHE Dublin, as it was when I went there in the early 80s. Then a new, tiny campus attached to the old Albert Agricultural College on the city's north side. I'd been offered a place in Trinity to study science, but this new college, my second choice, was just 10 minutes' walk from home. A real buzz was in the air about the innovative degrees on offer. Biotechnology, analytical science, and something rather nebulous sounding called communication studies. NIHE also had a unique selling point. It set up students with hands-on paid work placements during its degrees. In the bleak economy of the 1980s, with record unemployment, this sounded good to me. I declined my Trinity place and was offered NIHE instead. I saw my future in forensic science, white-coated, doing important detective work. But the campus at NIHE, I discovered, was not much more than a windswept concrete yard. The canteen was the noisy hub of the college, a two-storey red brick building, grandly titled the Henry Grattan, was the teaching centre. Cinder block walls, brown carpets, wood veneer desks. To describe it as utilitarian is being kind. There was no soaring campanile like in Trinity, no wood-panelled common room, no water feature, let alone a lake like UCD. This was Dullsville, Dublin 9. My brother, a medical doctor, now at Oxford no less, gave me good-natured grief about settling for the Ballymun Polytechnic. But when I'd adjusted to my surroundings, it wasn't so much the place that disappointed me, it was science. I fell out of love with it almost instantly. I'd come from a white-coated family. Dad, a pharmacist, the doctor brother, and it dawned on me that I was sleepwalking into the same line of work. Chemistry, biology, physics had been mental disciplines, puzzles I liked to solve. But once the leaving cert was over, the points accumulated, all passion for science was spent. Unable to turn another page of quadratic equations, I considered quitting in week three. But by mid-October, I'd become intrigued by a black-clad, Doc Marten red lipstick gang. Their laughter and witty banter echoed around the canteen as the entire 1,200-strong student body, it seemed, wolfed down chips and beans all around us. I eavesdropped on their conversations. Saussure, blah, blah, blah. Oh, but Lacan. Oh, no, but Berger's the real deal. Ah, no, you've got to buy Benjamin. I didn't know who they were talking about. I didn't care. Who were these brash loudmouths on this stolid science campus? Oh, they're from communication studies, bunch of pretentious so-and-sos. I longed to be a pretentious so-and-so. So I knocked on the door of the Dean of Communication Studies. What happened next changed my life. Dr. Martin Crowan, a charming man, sat and listened to me for an hour. Helen, I don't want to know what subjects you are good at. I want to know what you love. I'd never thought about my pastimes, my after-school activities, as something at which I could make a living. I was a keen photographer, having learned in Sister Mel's class in the darkroom of our Glasnevin convent. I made goofy comedy and chat shows with my pals, with my Panasonic cassette recorder and tinny microphone. Amateur hour, but it was fun picking music tracks and making up characters. I was a bit of a movie buff, and also an avid documentary watcher. I knew the TV schedules of RTE and BBC inside out. "I'll make a few calls," said Dr. Crowan. The next day, back went the science tomes, and I walked into cultural history with lecturer Luke Gibbons holding forth on the layers of meaning within the TV drama The Ballroom of Romance. The phrase, "Will you come into the field, Bridie?" stays with me still. I was instantly hooked. My world expanded as I immersed myself in subjects ending in "ix": statistics, economics, linguistics. I met Emer from Raheny, Pat from Kildare, Porrick from Sligo, Valerie from Castle Gregory, all sparky, witty, wordy. We roamed Dublin, weighed down with massive U-matic video cameras and with portable tape recorders the size of microwave ovens hanging off our wilting shoulders. I'm reminded of Christy Moore's line in Listoon Varna about media people making tapes, taking breaks and throwing shapes. We spent evenings in the sanctuary of the Slipper pub where a pint cost a punt. NIHE back then didn't even have a student bar. It was so new, the campus used to get letters addressed to the Northern Ireland Housing Executive. We had to make our own fun. In cramped Santry Digs, music was our shared love. The Smiths, Lloyd Cole and the Commotions, Simple Minds, Talking Heads. Crammed into smoke-filled rooms, we'd watch classic films on crackling VHS tapes, John Ford's Finest or Kubrick's back catalogue. Any steamy scenes were met with red faces, bar the odd, yahoo ya boya, hardly the stuff of normal people. We were abnormal 80s people. Forget mobile phones, even email wouldn't come for another 10 years. We were just on the cusp, oh, the excitement of using floppy disks. We had 3 years of making magic, but after the hard graft, the essays, the assignments, the video, audio and photography projects, where would we get jobs? Step up the NIHE's pioneering intra programme, a 6 months paid work placement. I got a place in RTE and they hired me when I graduated. A few years later, the BBC beckoned, and I'd spend the next 30 years in London working my way to the top of BBC television. Recently returned to live in Ireland, I was given a tour of present-day DCU by its then-president, Brian McCraw. Multi-tiered buildings, multicultural students, multidisciplines in research and innovation, the biggest concert hall in Ireland, 18,000 students on 85 acres. The original windswept courtyard now dwarfed by canyons of steel and concrete that had risen around it. An astonishing transformation. I was in awe of what had happened to our little local college. But glad to spot, in the canteen, that chips and beans are still on the menu. As for my own pioneering gang, you'll see the odd Emmy, BAFTA or MTV award on our mantelpieces. Our glittering prizes. So happy birthday, NIHE, DCU, for spotting potential, for letting us run riot with mad ideas, for giving us that critical head start. Dullsville, DCU? No, it was Dublin 9's Dream Factory. Shadow, shine the lights on me. In all of my life, so that much more I see.
Every morning, I reach for the pewter caddy, take off the first lid, then pop up the second airtight lid, releasing the scent of coffee that has been trapped like a genie into the air. Tracing the engravings of flowers, birds and Chinese characters, I'm transported to Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, and the days we spent there, halfway between Australia and home. Exhausted and grubby from the long-haul flight, we found ourselves in the foyer of a posh hotel, a pianist playing old songs by Frank Sinatra and Perry Como, trolleys with golden handles and full of expensive luggage being wheeled towards the lifts, our Birkenstocks slapping across the mirror shiny floor, sand still between our toes and tatty rucksacks on our backs. The receptionist, in his clean white shirt and hotel uniform, nodded politely. I held out a paper token that had been soaked from the October rains in Australia and waited for him to sneer and show us to the door. But he just took it from me and gave us the usual forms to fill in. Your credit card, please. Oh, we don't actually have a credit card, we said, knowing that it was maxed up to the hilt. No problem. Just give me a deposit of €100 and we will return it to you when you leave. Silence. Then, well, we only have about €100 left. He took pity on us and handed over the plastic fob, telling us which room was ours in that skyscraper of a hotel. A bed. That's all we needed, a bed and a cup of tea and wait. Yes, they had Kit Kats in the minibar. You can't eat that. It's €15 and we're here for two, nearly 3 days. I have to have it. I need it. So we split the Kit Kat and drank tea and wondered how we were going to survive as we checked out the prices on the menu. We'll find the local markets, buy loads of fruit, smuggle it back to the room and camp out here until it's time to leave for the airport. Then we slept and slept. When we emerged from that stupor, we left the hotel and wandered jet-lagged through the city. We stumbled on the food halls where we were able to buy the most delicious food, light and spicy, for a couple of euro. On our last day, a taxi man offered to give us a tour. We arranged a price and found ourselves with a bag of nuts, climbing 270 steps in the humid heat to the Batu Caves Hindu temple. Wild monkeys, long-tailed rhesus macaques, sprang down from the trees, thrusting their greedy fingers into the bag, landing on our shoulders and frightening the wits out of us. We handed over the bag and then dutifully inspected the Hindu statues in the temple, lit incense at the ancient altar and trudged back down the steps to our taxi man who offered us a halved coconut brimming with milk. Our next stop was a tour of the Royal Selangor Pewter Factory and Visitor Centre. The guide bowed to us as honoured visitors and began to educate us on the properties of pewter, its ability to keep everything fresh forever, and the craftsmanship that goes into each piece. Alas, we couldn't take it in because we knew what was coming, and sure enough, we were eventually ushered into the sumptuous air-conditioned shop where perfectly groomed Asian women rushed towards the glass counters to serve us and display pewter vessels of every size. Another major byproduct of tin mining is onyx for health and good luck. And a trove of onyx bracelets, earrings and necklaces glinted like black diamonds under the lights. "Buy something for the beautiful lady," they ordered. We smiled and nodded, wondering how we were going to get out without causing offence. "We can afford the bracelet," I said. "Or that pewter caddy," John said. "The bracelet is lovely, though. Buy something for the lady." And so we gave the credit card one last whirl and it went through. And we left with the caddy and the bracelet. The bracelet lasted for 2 years, but the caddy has given me 15 years and more to appreciate pewter and its ability to keep my coffee fresh and fragrant. The kind of vessel that could be buried with your ashes and dug up in years to come, your essence rising like incense from a mountain temple.
John Bower Bradley was not a well-known public figure, but to hundreds, even thousands of boys and girls who played soccer for the club he founded in the 1950s with his lifelong friend Eddie Roach, he was a person of consequence. On my last visit to Venice in autumn 2019, I thought of Bower, who had died a few weeks earlier, and who was, in his own way, a Venetian gentleman. I love Venice. From the first moment I stepped from the boat onto the quayside at Piazza San Marco, I felt at home in that city of infinite variety, a city that is half real, half imagined. Approach Venice from the sea in October or November, when the fog sits on the lagoon, and the city emerges like an apparition floating on the water, and you believe Venice to be a shimmering illusion. Approach it by train in midsummer, and you will see the cranes load and unload the goods needed to sustain the city and support the 50,000 or so Venetians who call Venice their home, and the estimated 20 million tourists who visit annually, or did so before the pandemic. There is nothing chimeric about the industrial hub of the city. It is brutally real. Of course, there is no single Venice. The city is composed of a series of tiny islands linked by bridges, divided by canals. Each is distinctive. But no matter where you are in Venice, at 6 o'clock in the evening, you will witness a similar spectacle. For it is then that the inhabitants of the city come out of their dwellings to stroll the main thoroughfares of their district, to look in the shop windows, greet neighbours, do their shopping, walk their dog, promenade. And afterwards they will sit with their friends and family outside a neighbourhood bar, sipping an aperitivo. Go to the same bar for a succession of evenings, and you may be rewarded with a nod of recognition that marks an acceptance, if not a welcome, of your presence in their midst. You know, Venetians have a complicated relationship with the tourists upon whom the city depends for its survival. When I was there in October of last year, how long ago that now seems, an elderly Venetian lady barged me out of the way as I stopped to admire a view from a bridge at a busy crossing. She was not polite. This was a few weeks before the exceptional high tide, the Aqua Alta of November 12th, 2019, the second highest ever recorded, when the tidal waters rose over 6 feet above sea level and inundated St. Mark's Square, flooding the subterranean chambers of San Marco, the salt water absorbed into the stones of the ancient basilica. In October, the tide was already licking the edges of the city and washing up along low-lying quaysides with intent. Wandering the city, I found myself, as one often does, by the Rialto Bridge. Here, I admired the renovated Fondaco dei Tedeschi, the old commercial centre and warehouse for German and Flemish merchants in the city. The inscription on the marble pillars caught my eye. No obscene words and insults, no card games, no commotion, no fights. Otherwise, free to trade. It is a motto that Bower Bradley would have understood and approved, one suited to his philosophy and temperament. I often think that my attachment to Venice is bound up with the fact that I grew up in a shadowy version of the real city. Going to school, I walked along the Grand Canal. I cannot count the number of times I traversed Rialto Bridge, or the bridge over the Grand Canal that led to Dolphin's Barn, which took its name from the merchant family whose warehouse once stood adjacent to the waterway. And if Venice has its fair share of churches dedicated to Our Lady, Santa Maria, the street names of Dublin's Little Venice read like a litany of the Virgin. Lourdes, Ave Maria, Rosary, Morning Star, Our Ladies, Loreto. This is Maryland, adjacent to Fatima Mansions. When others were in despair at the drug crisis that ravaged the area in the 1980s and 90s, Bower Bradley and Eddie Roach offered something positive to young people, a chance to play soccer, the beautiful game of their imagination. With good humour and patience, they cajoled and pushed and encouraged hundreds of youths to play for the club they founded, named after the road where they lived, Lourdes Celtic. And Lourdes Celtic performed its own kind of miracle in an area of the greatest disadvantage, the miracle of transformation on a field of dreams. All you had to do to enter this dream world was to accept the rules. No obscene words, no insults, no commotion, no fights. Otherwise, free to play. As a young boy, I accepted the invitation and played for 10 years with these good men. In October 2019, the winds were already causing the Adriatic to flood the Venetian lagoon and causing the seawater to inundate parts of the ancient city. And I was carried on my own flood of memories, crossing my Rialto Bridge in Dublin to rendezvous with my teammates before traipsing across the city to play in the Dublin and District Soccer Leagues with our Venetian gentlemen, Bower Bradley and Eddie Roach. What news on the Rialto? What news, good gentlemen?
The writing on this morning's programme was My Sarajevan Family by Frank Schuldeis, 0 Degrees by Donal Hayes, Dublin 9's Dream Factory was by Helen O'Rahilly. The Properties of Pewter by Lanny O'Hanlon. And What News on the Rialto, Good Gentleman, was by Kevin McDermott. And the music, Sarajevo by Max Richter. An Jocchi Tua Waglialum, played on harp by Anne-Marie O'Farrell. Glittering Prize by Simple Minds. And Let's Have Another Cup of Coffee by Irving Berlin. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Carolyn Dempsey and the producer is Sarah Binchy. And for more on this or other RTE culture programmes, take a look at rte.ie/culture.
RTE Radio 1.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.